Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say he liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. He's been nominated four times for a James Beard Award, as well as a number of other accolades. But most rewarding is the work he's done in the community, helping raise funds for various organizations, as well as mentoring upcoming chefs. Joining us is Chef Gregory Leon from Amalinda, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary in Milwaukee. What exactly does the word Amalinda mean?
Well, thank you for inviting me today. Amalinda is a combination of my parents' names. My father is Venezuelan, and his name is Amilcar, so that's where the AMI comes from. And my mother's name was Linda, so that's where the other half of the name comes. Also, in Venezuela, which is where I grew up, that's where my father's from, they have a custom of naming your houses. Rather than having numbers, houses will have names. This is for everybody. It's not like, oh, you have a mansion. And Amalinda was the name of the home of my brothers, and I grew up in Venezuela.
You weren't born there. You were born in what, Tulsa?
Yeah, I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
How'd you end up in Venezuela?
My father's Venezuelan. And so my mother, who was from Superior, Wisconsin, at a very young age, moved to Oklahoma because of my grandfather's work. And my father, in the 60s, went to Oklahoma to study business and petroleum and marketing. And they just met. And after he graduated from college, which was like 1975, I was five, he wanted to move back to Venezuela for a few years. So we were there for 14 years.
How did that affect you? You were still pretty young. So it was just like, I'm just going to go with mom and dad.
Yeah, I mean, like having a choice. Yeah. Like, you're five, so you do what your parents tell you. So as a kid, you're not really paying attention to what's going on. You don't realize the magnitude of the great things that are happening to you in your life until you're much later. I'm extremely grateful that my parents did this, and I don't even think they really knew the ramifications of what that decision would bring. I'm incredibly lucky. Like, I got to travel through the Andes Mountains as a kid. I got to see Angel Falls, which is the tallest waterfall in the world, as a kid. Spent a lot of time on the Caribbean. Very thankful for that childhood.
What was life like for you? I mean, obviously you got to travel and see things that normal little kids don't get to see, but what was family life like?
My family was very white picket fence, two dogs kind of situation. My parents were together until my mother passed away. And my dad, to this day, will still say that that was the love of his life. I have two younger brothers. My dad comes from a very big family, so there was always family at our house. On the weekends, there was always cooking. Usually on the weekends, the men would cook. So a lot of barbecuing, a lot of soup. They would play dominoes, a lot of drinking.
Wait, I love this. The men would cook?
On the weekends, yes.
Okay. What was a family feast when you were growing up in Venezuela like?
On the weekends, it would either be a barbecue. So, you know, they're throwing stuff on the grill. A lot of red meat. Or there's a soup that they eat in the Caribbean called sancocho, which is like this giant pot. And you can either make it out of chicken or beef or fish. So depending on the part of the country you live in, that determines what the soup is going to be made out of. And so they would just put the soup up in the morning and people would come over. And again, they'd play dominoes, they drink, they dance. And then like around 5 or 6 after the horse races had been announced, we would eat.
Were you ever drawn to cooking when you were little?
I was certainly intrigued by it. You know, Venezuela is a fairly macho-centric culture. So cooking is left to the women, especially we're talking 70s, 80s. When I was a child and a teenager. So it was something that interested me. I would take my mother's cookbooks and I would go into the bedroom and read them. But it wasn't something that I was like, hey, this is what I want to do. I have a friend from middle school who swears that I told him I wanted to be a chef when I grew up, but I don't really remember that. But he's a pretty honest person, so I don't think he would make that up.
Do you remember the first thing you made?
Well, I have another friend from high school who I still stay in contact with. And I made brownies to take to his house. We were all going to hang out. And I used salt instead of sugar.
Ooh.
Yeah. He likes to remind me of that.
Not a good start for a chef.
No, but you know, you got to start somewhere.
You came back to the United States. You were what, about 19 years old?
No, I was 19.
What drew you there? You were an adult at that point. Why'd you come back?
Again, my parents were like, we're moving back. So
you didn't have a choice.
I didn't have a choice. My mother, we were supposed to be in Venezuela for a couple of years, and it ended up being 14. And in 1989, they had their first coup before Chavez became president. And I think my mother was just like, it's time to go. I want to go live close to my family. So we came back to the U.S.
Do you remember any of the upheaval at that time?
I do. I was 18. I remember, you know, a lot of running around at the school. I remember a lot of parents getting there early to get the kids. You know, I remember seeing some black smoke coming up from the city and maybe like some military helicopters, but nothing insane. You know, I don't remember seeing any tanks or anything like that.
It wasn't like you were afraid.
No, I thought it was pretty interesting. I think my mother was more afraid than anybody else.
It was probably a good decision to come back then.
You know, hindsight 2020. So yes, looking at how the country has turned out, yes, it was probably. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen here.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
She's like, you know, you're trying really hard, but you're not very good at this.
Chef Gregory Leone talks about faking it till you make it.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Chef Gregory Leone from Amalinda. When did you think about becoming a chef, going into the food business?
It was the 90s, you know, 91, 92. I still hadn't dawned on me that that was a career that you could, you know, there were no examples. There were very few famous chefs at that time. We're talking about 1992, 93.
The Food Channel hadn't been invented.
I think the Food Channel had just started, I think. Yeah. Like, they still cooked on the Food Channel. That's how long ago that was. And I remember I had gone to the University of Oklahoma and then got kicked out because I had really bad grades because I just wasn't studying anything that interested me. And I was kind of floundering. Like, I went to work at a restaurant as a waiter. So that was my first restaurant job, was working at TGI Fridays, waiting tables. And I never, you know, you would go into the kitchen to get breadsticks and I think like make sundaes, and that was about it. And then one day I was sitting at home and there used to be a show on the Discovery Channel called Great Chefs of the World or Great Chefs of the Northeast. And it was an hour show. It had three chefs. Each chef would prepare a dish, a starter, an entree, and a dessert. So one chef would do the starter, one would do the entree. They wouldn't really talk to the camera, and they wouldn't really explain what they were doing. There was a very calm voiceover of a lady who would explain what the chefs were doing. But it wasn't the kind of show that you, I'm going to watch the show to learn how to make a dish. There was just, they wouldn't give you measurements or anything. Like, you're just watching these people cook. And I remember watching that show and being like, oh, that's what I want to do. But again, you know, we're talking early 90s. There was no cachet in being a chef or a restaurant owner. When I told my dad I wanted to be a chef, I had also at the same time told him that I was gay. And he was more upset about me being a chef than me being gay.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did, actually. I really expected an argument about, you know, being gay and him being okay with me being a chef because he enjoyed food and he worked as a cook when he was in college, when he was supporting my mother and I. And yeah, he was not happy about it. Now he is, you know, he's...
What bothered him most about you becoming a chef?
I just don't think, you know, back then it was a career. Like, what are you going to do? Either you're going to go work in a hotel, in the dungeon of a hotel, or what? Like, I don't, at that time, there really was no celebrity chef. I think Emeril Lagasse was like one of the only national chefs. Like, I'm assuming that if you lived in a city like LA or New York and there were chefs that people knew there, then you would know them. But it's not like now that you can go anywhere in the country and you drop Nancy Silverton's name and people know who she is.
When did you go from the front of the house, when you worked at TJ Fridays, to being in the kitchen?
There was a big span. I'm trying to think. I worked at Fridays right after college, so like 91, 92, maybe 93. And then I went out to California to begin my career in December of 94.
First time you walked in a kitchen, what were you doing?
Oh, my God, I was scared. I was so scared. I had never worked in a professional kitchen. I had done some cooking at home. By this point, I'd bought some cookbooks, but really knew nothing. I knew none of the terminology. I knew zero. And I got on a bus and went out to San Francisco, sight unseen. I'd never been there. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a job. I had $500, I think, $700. But a friend of mine had been there, and he's like, if you're really serious, you need to get out of Oklahoma. You're never going to become a chef here. So I was like, I'll go to California, San Francisco. It's warm. It's December. If I have to sleep in the park for a few days, it'll be sunny. You know, I did not know about the difference between Northern and Southern California. And I got there 3 days later and it was pouring down rain. And I needed to find a job. And I knew that I wanted to work in kitchen. So I walked by this building that looked really cool. And that was like the only reason I went in and applied for a job. It was because I liked the space.
What kind of restaurant was it?
Well, it's called Zuni Cafe. It's still there. It's a cornerstone of the San Francisco culinary scene. Judy Rogers was the chef and owner. She's since passed away. But I knew nothing about it. And I was just like, oh, this place looks cool. You know, little did I know that I just applied at one of San Francisco's greatest restaurants, and I lied on my application to get the job. I had no experience.
What did you say?
Oh, I couldn't tell you exactly what it was. I mean, that was like 30 years ago. But I'm sure I embellished my experience and told her I had worked in kitchens and I knew what I was doing, which was not the case. And
so were you went over your head then those
way
first
over my
couple
head.
Days?
Yeah, way over my head. And remember, it's not like she could ask me to do something and be like, oh, I'm going to go to the restroom, and then I'd pull out my cell phone and Google it. So I learned how to say, whenever she would ask me to do something that I didn't know, I would say, why don't you show me how you guys do it here? So I learned Zuni way. She quickly, I think, caught on to the fact that I didn't know what I was doing. It only lasted like a 3-month probation period. She was very nice when she let me go, but she did fire me after 90 days. She's like, you know, you're trying really hard, but you're not very good at this.
What did you do then?
Look for another job.
Well, by this time, you've got a little skill.
Well, I mean, there's only so much skill you can pick up in 90 days. So I knew how to hold a knife, you know, and basic stuff. And by this time, every time I would get paid, I would go buy cookbooks. I'm sure there were like some random restaurants in between Zuni Cafe and then Cafe Museo, which was a restaurant on the bottom floor of the Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco. They had just redone the building. So I went to go work there for Chef Gordon Drysdale. And while I was interviewing with him, then I was honest. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. My intention was to save up money and then go to the California Culinary Academy. That's how I landed. That's what it was called back then. But after working in a restaurant for about 2 to 3 years, I was like, I think I'll save my money and just learn on the job.
So you never went to culinary
never,
school?
Never, no.
Coming up at WTMJ Conversations.
So I would work at Cafe Museo for lunch, but at 4:30 in the morning, I would have to go to Fox City Diner, do desserts for the restaurant, do some breads, I think, and then they would open for lunch. So I'd have to make sure everything was done.
Chef Gregory Leone from Amalinda talks about moving on up in the kitchen.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Chef Gregory Leone from Amalinda. It's interesting that Chef Drysdale decided to hire you in spite of your lack of experience.
I think he needed bodies, and he's like, this guy will do anything, so let's go ahead and hire him. So I worked the line there for lunch, and he got super crazy. And then I had expressed my interest in pastry work. So he says, I will get you to work with our corporate pastry chef. So it was an organization much like Bartolotta's is here. They had different concepts. So I would work at Cafe Museo for lunch, but at 4:30 in the morning, I would have to go to Fox City Diner, which was also a fairly well-regarded restaurant in San Francisco. It was in the Visa commercials in the 2000s, I think. Yeah. So I would get there at 4:30, do desserts for the restaurant, do some breads, I think, and then they would open for lunch. So I'd have to make sure everything was done. And then I would leave, I think it usually was around 11:30, to go to Cafe Museo, and then I would work there until about 2:33.
How did you finally start moving up the ranks in the kitchen?
Oh, God. You know, it took a hot minute. There's nothing really that I did in San Francisco that I think would be of much interest to anybody, just because I was always somebody else's line cook or a pantry cook. I did take over the reins as executive chef of this place called Piops, but that place was on its way out. Like, it was on life support by the time I got there. But it was a fun experience. You know, you're 27, 28, all of a sudden you're the executive chef of a French restaurant, very small restaurant. I opened Tapeo, which was a tapas restaurant. That was also an adventure. And it was just a matter of, like, luck, I think, had a lot to do with it. Meeting the right people, making good connections. And I'd like to think good at what I did, although I'm certainly way better at it now than I was back then.
San Francisco is such a foodie city.
It is. It really is.
And I mean, what, you're less than 100 miles away from the French Laundry.
We are, yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever go there?
I never did. A, it was way out of my price range. And B, I might get in trouble. While I can appreciate that style of food and the amount of work that goes into it, it seems a little too fussy to me. And while I have enjoyed meals at restaurants of that style, you know, most notably, I had lunch at Arpège in Paris, which was just insanely good. And his food is like that. It's small, a little fussy, but it was
tweezers, right?
Yeah, yeah. But it was incredible. I cried halfway through the meal. Like, it was so good. There are other places that interest me more. You know, if I all of a sudden I find myself in Napa and I've got an extra $500 in my pocket or however much it is, sure. But I don't think I would go out of my way just to go either. And no shade to Chef Thomas Keller or anybody there. They're incredible chefs and cooks.
Why did you end up in Milwaukee, or how did you end up in Milwaukee?
So in 2012, for the last 2 years, from like 2010 to 2012, life kept kicking me in the ass. And it was telling me that it was time to leave San Francisco, but I was just so, no, I have to stay here. And my whole take on it, if I leave San Francisco without opening a restaurant here, I'm a failure. That's just my mindset. And I remember going and eating with my friend Kimberly, and we're eating, and I'm just like, Kimberly, I don't know what to do. Like, I'm trying really hard to get my life together, and, you know, it's just not working. So she says, well, maybe the universe is telling you it's time to leave. And I was like, well, I can't leave. Where am I going to go? Like, I have to stay here and open a restaurant. She says, well, maybe the plan was you come here, you're here for 18 years, and you go someplace else now. So I thought about it, and I thought about it. And at the beginning of spring of 2012, I was like, I'm done. I'm done here. You know, it was very expensive to live there. I was 42. I had roommates. I was like, I don't really want to live with roommates at the age of 42. So I packed up all my belongings. I put them in my friend Doug's basement, and my dog and I traveled the U.S. The goal was to visit cities where I knew people, where I could relocate, maybe cities I'd visited, and cities that had a food scene, because I knew I wanted to open a restaurant. That's always been the goal since the beginning, and I knew I would never want to change careers, because I have a hard time imagining what I would do. And so I went to Boise. I went up Sun Valley to kind of get away from the world for like 2 weeks, and then just started traveling. And one of the cities I went to was Portland, Oregon. I had some very good friends there and fell in love with it. And I was like, this is it. This is where I'm moving to. I'm going to move to Portland. I'm going to open a little food truck. So I traveled. I went back to South America. End of August, I'm in Oklahoma visiting my brothers. And a good friend of mine who lives here is texting me. And he says, come visit Milwaukee. The food scene here is just starting to, like, explode. And I was like, no, I don't know where that is. So I had to look it up on a map.
You didn't know where Milwaukee
was? I had no idea where it was. I knew nothing about it. Not even, like, the connections to the TV shows. So I looked it up on a map. And I was like, oh, it's on the water. That's great. I don't know. It looks pretty far up north. And I had been able to travel all summer because I had a friend who worked for Alaska Airlines. She's like, here's some vouchers. This is my contribution to your adventure. And at the time, Alaska Airlines did not come to Milwaukee. So, you know, I'm texting him. I said, I don't have extra money. I've been living off of what little savings I have. I can't. It's not in the cards right now. I can't afford it. I'll come visit you later. And the plan was I was going to go back to San Francisco, make a wedding cake for some friends, and then go up to Portland. And about 2 days later, he texts me. He says, I had some extra miles. I got you a ticket. Be at the airport at this time on Friday. And it's like, you're crazy. I guess I'm coming to visit you. And so I came out of here. I was here for about a week. Got here on a Friday. And my friend was very smart. He took me to a bunch of restaurants. And I think by the following Wednesday, I was like, okay, this place is kind of cool. It reminds me a little bit of Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is where I was born and where my family is. But it has this vibe of a big city, but it's not like draining. It was summer, so it was beautiful. And by the following Friday, him, my friend Jeff, and my friend Sandy took me to eat at this restaurant that had just opened. I think it had been open for about 6 months, called Odd Duck. And I remember sitting there eating and thinking to myself, oh, this place could be in San Francisco. The place was packed. It was a Friday night. You know, I was like, okay, cool. Clearly there's a food culture here. And then I went outside to smoke a cigarette, and I was talking to Ross and Melissa, who's the executive chef and owners. I think her title is a general manager and owner. And I thought she was the hostess, and I thought he was just some line cook. I had no idea who they were. And I'm just asking him some questions. I was like, you know, what is it like here? Blah, blah, blah. Do people appreciate food? Went back inside. I sat down, and Sandy looks at me, and she says, you just need to stay here and open a pop-up restaurant. And I was like, Sandy, you've had too much wine. I have no money to do that. I can't. And well, here we are, 13 years later.
So the pop-up was first.
We started the pop-up in December of 2013.
And if people don't know what a pop-up is.
So pop-up is, let's say you have a concept, you want to start your own restaurant. So you come to me and you're like, hey, Greg, I want to start a business, but I don't have the money for space, or I don't want to sink it that much money up front. I want to make sure people like what I'm doing. So I would let you pop up at my restaurant on the nights that I'm closed. So you would turn my restaurant into whatever your concept was for the night or for however long. And then I recommend anybody who's thinking about opening a restaurant to do it like that first.
Why?
You get to practice your food on real people. You get to introduce yourself and your cooking style to the dining community. To make a little bit of money without a lot of overhead. It helps you work out all the weird kinks that you have not thought about that you will have to deal with. It helps you form a relationship with the local food writers and food scenes, develop a relationship with farmers and purveyors. I can't imagine opening a restaurant and not doing it this way.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
I wish people learned what tariffs were, because the other countries are not paying for it. You, the consumer, is paying for it. If I have to pay more for an ingredient, then I have to recoup that money, so I'm going to have to pass it on to my customers.
James Beard nominee Chef Gregory Leone from Amalinda talks about how tariffs are affecting the restaurant business.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Chef Gregory Leone from Amalinda. When did you say, all right, this is going to be brick and mortar? At what point did you say it's time?
Brick and mortar was always the end goal. I don't think I woke up one day and said it's time. You know, we had done the pop-up for about a year, and our Pollyanna views of the world were like, oh, we're just going to make tons of money, and then we'll save up all this money, and then we'll open a restaurant. So for about a year, we were making enough money. We could pay our bills, travel, do some fun things, but we weren't saving a lot. And at the time, I was with my partner, Ori Leone, and he, you know, God bless him, he was in his late 20s and was just like, we can do anything. You know, that age when you're 20 and you're like, I can conquer the world. So after the pop-up, we did the pop-up for about a year. Nell was going to start a nighttime concept at the National. And we already kind of knew that. So it's like, oh, either we find a space to move into or we find someplace else to do a pop-up. And I woke up one morning and I was like, this is just not, you know, we haven't saved enough money. This is not going to happen. It's not in the cards. I'm just going to get a job, go work for somebody else. And Ori kept saying, well, you don't want to work for anybody else. And I was like, correct. What am I going to do? Like, this is clearly not in the cards. So we had some friends who had a place on water in Wisconsin. It was like a soup joint. And they had said, you can use our space at night. Got off on Milwaukee and Wisconsin and started to walk towards Water Street. And we walked by the spot, 315 East Wisconsin Avenue. And now the town was not on my list of places where I wanted to open. There was a hood in the space. That was the only thing that we could see. And Ori's like, oh, look at the space. And I was like, we don't have money. Why are we calling these people? Like, what are you going to pay with? So he called and he set up an appointment to tour the space. We went in there. It had been closed for 4 years. And prior to that, it had been a Thai restaurant. I believe the space has been a restaurant since the late 80s, maybe. The building is from like 1821, 1831. So it's a pretty old building. I remember walking in there and just being like, this place is gross. I mean, I won't share the words that I used to describe the spot, but it was just like, the gross. No, I don't want to open here. And Ori's degree was in design. And he's like, you just have to look past that. And it's like, well, my brain does not work that way. And I'm not, there's no way I'm looking past any of this. I was like, I hate it. I don't like it. So he went home. And behind the scenes, he was already working on making sure that was going to be our home. And so I remember going and signing the lease and looking at him. And I'm like, we don't have any money in the bank. What are we doing? Are we going to get sued? You know, the rest is history.
All right. So how did you decide on your concept of food?
You know, when I started cooking in 1990, I started cooking in 94, but in 1997, I got the chance to randomly go to Spain and meet an American chef who had had a restaurant in Madrid. He was very successful and well-known, and he was looking for a young American cook to come learn from him and then hopefully take over the restaurant. So I went to Spain, ended up not taking over the restaurant, clearly, but he became a good friend and mentor of mine, and I fell in love with Spanish cooking and the relationship that they have with food. And some of my earliest childhood memories actually involve Spanish food. We, as I said, grew up in Venezuela. And one of the cities we lived in, my parents had these friends from Spain. And grandma lived with them. And I remember going to their house for dinner one night and just eating croquetas, which I love. Tortilla de patatas, which is a Spanish potato, onion, and egg omelet, which is delicious. And being like, this is so good, but why are we eating an omelet at nighttime and why is it cold? Because they make it and then you just let it sit on the counter and you eat it at room temperature. And then Cabrales blue cheese, which is like one of the most pungent blue cheeses. It's made with three different kinds of milk. It's not, I'm like, you have to be a lover of blue cheese. And so I remember trying this at their house and being like, wow, this is incredible. And it made an impression on me. So many years later, when I was in Spain, I was like, I like the relationship that they have with food and cooking and how they respect it. And eating is not just a necessity to them. It's part of the overall plan of the day and it's part of what you do and you celebrate it and you carve out time out of your day to actually do it. You know, you don't see people walking around eating. So that's how Spain came into play. And then I worked with a Portuguese chef. And I was like, I kind of like this too. So when it came time to decide what we were going to do at Amelinda, I was just like, we'll just be inspired by the Iberian Peninsula. It sometimes can be confusing to people, and we have to explain it. Because if we say Spanish food, they just automatically think it's Mexican.
Did you find that the idea of having Spanish Portuguese food on your menu was a selling point because it was so unique to this area?
I think so. I mean, when we started our pop-up, there was one or maybe two other Spanish restaurants in Milwaukee. I know there's a really famous one in Racine, which I haven't been to yet, and I can't remember the name of it right now. I think it's in Racine. There used to be like one place in Milwaukee, and then Movida opened. But yeah, there was nobody doing the whole Iberian Peninsula. Plus, you know, when we opened, I feel like the dining community, not necessarily in Milwaukee, but just in general, thought that the only thing Spaniards ate were like paella and tapas. And so we do not do paella or tapas at Amelinda. We focus on the rest of the culinary spectrum of the Iberian Peninsula. So we'll take, you know, you'll come in sometimes and see a traditional dish, but we've added our aesthetic to it, our flavor likes and dislikes. But most of the time, we're just mostly inspired by their flavors and techniques. And, you know, sometimes we'll look outside of the peninsula and look at some of their colonies. You know, we'll look at Goan, which is in India, which used to be a colony of Portugal. Same thing with Macau. It's in China, it used to be their colony. And then, you know, Spain had its finger all over the world. So
Do you find it difficult to acquire some of the ingredients that you need?
Not these days. I mean, as much as I...
When you first started, though.
No, even when we started 10 years ago, not really. No, there's... I mean, if you dig around, right now, I'm currently trying to find Portuguese cheeses.
Aren't the tariffs going to hurt?
Yes, they are going to hurt. I wish people learned and knew what tariffs were and stopped listening to that talking head, because the other countries are not paying for it. You, the consumer, is paying for it. Because if I have to pay more for an ingredient, then I have to recoup that money. So I'm going to have to pass it on to my customers, which I hate to do. Because we want Amelinda to be a special place for you, but we don't want it to be a special occasion restaurant, if that means. Yes, by all means, come celebrate your anniversary, your wedding. But we don't want to price people out of it where they're like, oh, I can only go there when it's a special occasion. We want people to be like, oh, it's a Wednesday night and I don't feel like cooking. I'm going to walk down to Amelinda. And so far, we've been pretty successful at keeping that balance. You know, am I retiring next year? Probably not. But it's okay. We do it for the love of it.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
This whole process lasts until about June, which is also typically the slow season. So we continuously get nominated every year. So we haven't had a slow season in 4 years.
Chef Gregory Leon from Amelinda says he doesn't really want to win a James Beard Award.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Chef Gregory Leon from Amelinda. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Pretty early on, though, you realized you had a winner. I mean,
maybe not.
No, really?
I mean,
because
at least...
there were a lot of good reviews, mm-hmm. a lot of people talking about you because it was so unique.
I think the fact that we were a pop-up and we had that partnership with Nell from The National, that was, I think, very unique. I don't think anybody had done a regular pop-up like that. Like, this was a permanent restaurant. Yes, people have liked us since the get-go. You know, one of the first... The very first review I think we got was from Carol Deptola. She came and reviewed us as a pop-up, and I remember that was very controversial because a lot of cooks in town were like, well, how is he getting a review if he doesn't even have a restaurant? And she didn't give us any stars, but she did say, because she said they don't have their own space yet. But she did say, and, you know, I ran into her a couple weeks ago, we can now finally speak to each other because, you know, I'm allowed to know who she is. And she said that she still tells people this, but one of the lines in her review was, if I have friends coming in from out of town, this is a place I tell them to go eat at. That was pretty amazing to read that.
She really helped your reputation.
She did. I mean, her, Lori Frederick, helped open a lot of doors for me. I mean, I call Nell Benton Amelinda's godmother. I admire that woman and her cooking, and she's become a very good friend. And she's now on a crusade to make sure I have a nest egg for when I retire, if I retire. So that's our new project we're working on.
That first James Beard nomination, did it come as a surprise?
Yes, it did. You know, every year... We would, oh, it's coming up. But I would pay attention. I'd read the list, kind of grumble about it, and that was about it. I just never assumed.
Why'd that guy get it?
Yeah, I mean, there was always that one person that you're like, what are they doing on here? For the most part, I will say, though, like every year when I would look at the list and see the Milwaukee chefs on there, I was like, oh, they deserve it. Because Milwaukee's got some great people cooking here. Like, we're very lucky. That first nomination was right after the pandemic, so it was, we're talking about 2022. I was washing dishes. I think we were still very short-staffed. I was probably very tired. And it was during the day, and I remember Lori calling and saying congratulations. I was like, for what? For washing dishes? Like, what are you congratulating me about? And then she's like, well, you're semifinalist at the moment. That was pretty surprising. A lot of crying. It's nice to be recognized for your hard work. And I know that sounds to some people probably like, Jesus Christ, what an ego. But it's not that. It's just, it's nice to have people that you admire and that you followed your whole career and people that you look up to. Look at what you're doing and being like, well, okay, cool. You deserve some recognition because you're really good at this.
Three more nominations.
Three more. Yeah, we have a total of four now.
Do you ever think, why haven't I won yet?
No. You know, I'll share a little secret with you. Winning would be great. Winning would be amazing. I daydream about it, but mostly because I daydream about taking my staff up there to get the award with me. But the semifinalist comes out in January or February. And then this whole process lasts until about June, which is also typically the slow season. So we continuously get nominated every year. And so we haven't had a slow season in 4 years because people come in and they're talking about us. And so I have a very good friend here who's a chef, who's a past winner. And he has said before, he's like, while I'm very grateful for the award and the recognition, I wish I could still get nominated because it helps our name stay in people's mouth.
And once you win it.
My understanding is once you win a category, you can't be nominated for it again. So like if I were to win Best Chef Midwest or Outstanding Chef, which those two nominations are very surprising to me because that's more of a national kind of situation. You know, all I ever wanted to do was just cook a little bit of food and maybe make some extra money, travel, feed my dogs, you know.
In the early days of your restaurant, you decided to help organizations that were not for profits.
Correct.
What was it that drew you to that? Because not everybody does it.
You know, I wish I could say that when we're sitting there writing the business plan, I'm like, oh, and then this is going to be a big part of it. So I've had a lot of people over the last couple months, because of our 10th year anniversary, ask me about that aspect of the business. Why do you do this? What was the plan? There was never a plan. I learned that you could use a restaurant for more than just feeding people as we went along. So people ask me, why do you do these things? And I've always had a hard time answering it because there's no real reason. It's not like I wake up in the morning, I'm like, I'm going to help these people because of this and this and this. It's more like I am in a position to help these people, so I'm going to help these people.
And there's one organization that you have helped for many, many years, and it's personal for you.
Yeah, Vivance, that's a big one. They are the local HIV AIDS clinic, and they provide more than just medical help. They provide food and counseling and an array of services that people need. And so I know what it's like to need those services, being HIV positive myself. So if I can help them keep their doors open, especially with all the funds that are being cut right now, why wouldn't I?
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
Yeah, I might be HIV positive, but I have a restaurant that's very popular. I get to do what I love for a living. I get to travel. Grand scheme of things, not that bad of a life.
Chef Gregory Leon from Amelinda talks about being HIV positive.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Chef Gregory Leon from Amalinda. Amalinda has been known as being very supportive and friendly to the LGBTQ population here in Milwaukee. Why is that important?
I mean, what kind of member of that community would I be if I didn't make sure my restaurant was a safe space? You know, when we first opened, I'm very well aware that after 10 years, I've become the restaurant. The restaurant's become me. There's just no getting away from that. So anything I do or say is going to affect the restaurant. It's going to affect the business, and it can affect the livelihood of the people that work there. You know, I understand I've got 7 fantastic human beings that work there and depend on the restaurant to pay their bills and eat and live their life. And so for the first couple of years, we never really labeled ourselves as a LGBTQ-owned restaurant, but people who knew us knew us. They knew Ori and I were married. They knew we were the owners. And then after we were fairly well established, perhaps people who would have never gone to a restaurant that was owned by 2 gay men had become regulars. We had changed some hearts and minds. Then I'm like, okay, cool. Now we can start being a little bit more vocal. These people know us. They know who we are. They've met us as human beings. And so we started putting out the flag for Pride. Why would I not want to help the community? It's a very hard question for me to answer. My parents did a really good job at raising us. So shout out to my parents. They taught us that nobody is better than anybody else, no matter how much money you make or how talented or how great you are at your job. We're all the same. At the end of the day, we're all the same. So if I have a little bit more, why would I not try to help somebody else make their life a little bit better?
I have to ask you, and if you don't want to answer, I understand.
Sure.
But you said you're HIV positive.
Correct.
How has that affected your life?
I wish I could say, you know, it affected my life in this grandiose way, and it's been a nightmare just to make sure other people out there pay attention to what they're doing. And, you know, I was lucky enough that I became positive in 1999 when the advances in treatment had just switched over. So we're going from what was a cocktail of, like, I don't know, 20 pills that were pretty much poisonous to your body to something a little bit more advanced, shall we say, maybe not horrible side effects. And also the doctor that I had in San Francisco was one of the early on doctors who worked with HIV early on in the 80s. So I was very lucky. I think the worst part was just having to tell my family. And I didn't do that for probably about 12, 15 years. I just didn't want them to worry.
How did your dad react?
Well, he called. So at the time I was with my partner and he got pneumonia, got really sick. He was in the hospital. And so I remember my stepmother calling and she's like, I just don't understand. He's so young. And I just, without thinking, it just slipped. And I just think, remember, it was like in slow motion. I'm like, oh, God, okay, here goes this can of worms. And so my dad called me like within an hour. Well, you know, he's like, you said something to Patricia. I was like, yeah, I did. And he's like, what? And I was like, you know, it just, this happened. Sorry, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know how it happened. It just happened. I think they were all fairly concerned for a while. But I think now they've learned that it's not the death sentence that it used to be. But you should still try not to get it.
What do you think other people can learn, though, from you living such a long life with HIV and doing it with such a great attitude?
Well, again, you know, it's not a death sentence. Everything in life is subjective, I suppose. Yeah, I might be HIV positive, but I have a restaurant that's very popular. I get to do what I love for a living. I've surrounded myself with some incredible human beings. I'm very lucky. I have 2 dogs that love me. I have a nice place to live in. I get to travel. Grand scheme of things, not that bad of a life. You know what I mean? So I try to keep that in perspective. Are there days when I wake up and I'm like, ugh, I hate my life? Yeah, of course. But do I really mean it? No. And there's people out there who have a lot worse than I do, who still get up every morning and put a smile on their face. And so we like to call, when people complain about like stupid stuff, we call like white people problems. I try not to complain about my white people problems too much and be very thankful and grateful that life has turned out the way it did.
What's the future for Amalinda after 10 years?
You know, I always used to joke around and used to tell customers that after 10 years I was closing down, and I think they're all a little nervous right now. That place has become very important to them. And that's really surprised me that this little space means so much to other people. One of my favorite stories to tell is during the pandemic, right at the beginning when stimulus checks were sent out, we started getting stimulus checks from our guests. And they would tell us, we want you to take this money and use it to keep the restaurant alive, because Amalinda is a very important place to us.
That's unheard of.
And we want to make sure that Amalinda is still around when life gets back to normal and we can go out and eat again. I think this is one of the first times I've been able to tell that story without crying, which just to this day, I can't even describe. I'm just beside myself to think that people would do that. What's in the future? Well, we're currently working on a cookbook. This is going to be quite a project. My friend Jen Fishman, who's a professor at Marquette, is helping. I mean, she's literally writing the book. I'm just throwing recipes at her. It's a fun adventure, I guess. I hope she's listening to
this. What do you mean a fun adventure?
I hate office work. I just don't like office stuff. I don't like to sit down and type. Anything like that is just not in my wheelhouse. It's like pulling teeth. She's very good. You know, we meet. She has 3 or 4 tasks for me. She makes sure our meetings are only like 2 hours long. She tries to make it fun. So if you ever need to write a cookbook, she's the gal to call. But that takes about 2 years, I guess. It's a process. So we're working on that. I've had some people approach me with other projects. Some of them are not in Milwaukee. They're actually overseas. But I would never want to do anything that would hurt Amelinda. Amelinda is very important to me and means a lot to me. And I know it means a lot to a lot of other people. So I would never want to do anything that's going to jeopardize the quality of the food or the mere existence of the restaurant. So I think very hard about other things that I could do and how it would affect the restaurant. So we'll see what happens. If I can pull off this project and not affect the restaurant, it might be a go, but we'll see.
We will look forward to finding that cookbook. Have you decided what you're going to call it?
We've got a lot of different working titles. A couple of them I can't even say on the radio because it's like the name of the restaurant and then something that I say all the time at the restaurant when I get frustrated or mad. So use your own imagination. It's going to have about 100 recipes. Some of our customers' favorites will definitely be in there.
And so, what's your favorite that's going to be in it?
I like the asparagus pâté, which has become a favorite of our customers. I think the recipe in there that has the most sentimental meaning for me would be our signature olive oil and chocolate mousse. So in 1997, when I went to Spain for the first time, and I met Richard Stevens and hung out in his kitchen, one of the recipes he had, or one of the desserts he had on his menu was this mousse chocolate, and instead of butter, it was made with olive oil. It was one of the first things he taught me how to make. And so that recipe to me has a lot of meaning. He unfortunately passed away last year, and he never got to come see the restaurant, which is a little heartbreaking to me. But I know he's there in spirit, just like my mother is. So she never got to see the restaurant, but she's there in spirit. So I think that recipe, that's the one that means the most to me.
Chef Gregory Leal. From Amelinda, I can't thank you enough for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
We've been talking with Chef Gregory Leal from Amelinda, celebrating their 10th anniversary right here in Milwaukee. He talked about being a James Beard Award nominee and how he's not quite sure if he really wants to win that award. Now, if you joined us late and you'd like to hear our entire conversation with Chef Gregory, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.